Realizing he had taken on too great a foe, the man eased his string, turned, and ran off. Wolfgar turned back. Mickers, too, had sprinted away. "Now we'll have to watch out for them," Morik observed glumly when Wolfgar returned to him. "You cost us allies."
"I'll not ally myself with murdering thieves," Wolfgar said simply.
Morik jumped back from him.
"What am I if not a thief?"
Wolfgar's expression softened.
"Well, perhaps just one," he corrected with a chuckle.
Morik laughed uneasily.
"Here, my big and not-so-smart friend," he said, reaching for another bottle. "A drink to the two of us. Highwaymen."
"Will we find the same fate as our predecessors?"
Wolfgar wondered aloud.
"Our predecessors were not so smart," Morik explained. "I knew where to find them because they were too predictable. A good highwayman strikes and runs on to the next target area. A good highwayman seems like 10 separate bands, always one step ahead of the city guards, ahead of those who ride into the cities with information enough to find and defeat them."
"You sound as if you know the life well."
"I have done it from time to time," Morik admitted. "Just because we're living on the wild road doesn't mean we must live like savages."
The rogue repeated what was fast becoming his mantra. He held the bottle out toward Wolfgar. It took all the willpower he could muster for Wolfgar to refuse that drink. His shoulder ached, and he was still agitated about the thugs. Retreat into a swirl of semi-consciousness was very inviting at that moment. But he did refuse by walking away from a stunned Morik. Moving to the other end of the field, he scrambled up a tree, settled into a comfortable niche, and sat back to survey the outlying lands. His gaze was drawn repeatedly to the mountains in the north, the spine of the world, the barrier between him and that other world of Icewind Dale, that life he might have known and might still know. He thought of his friends again, mostly of Catti Bree. The barbarian fell asleep to dreams of her close in his arms, kissing him gently, a respite from the pains of the world. Suddenly Catti Bree backed away. And as Wolfgar watched, small ivory horns sprouted from her forehead, and great bat wings extended behind her. A succubus, a demon of the abyss, tricking him again in the hell of Ertu's torments, assuming the guise of comfort to seduce him. Wolfgar's eyes popped open wide, his breath coming in labored gasps. He tried to dismiss the horrible images, but they wouldn't let him go. Not this time. So poignant and distinct were they that the barbarian wondered if all of this, his last months of life, had been but a ruse by Ertu, to bring him hope again so that the demon might stomp it. He saw the succubus, the horrid creature that had seduced him.
"No," Wolfgar growled, for it was too ugly a memory, too horrible for him to confront it yet again.
"I stole your seed,"
the succubus said to his mind, and he could not deny it. They had done it to him several times in the years of his torment, had taken his seed and spawned Alu demons, Wolfgar's children. It was the first time Wolfgar had been able to consciously recall the memory since his return to the surface. The first time the horror of seeing his demonic offspring had forced itself through the mental barriers he had erected. He saw them now, saw Ertu bring to him one such child, a crying infant, its mother succubus standing behind the demon. He saw Ertu present the infant high in the air, and then, right before Wolfgar's eyes, right before its howling mother's eyes, the great demon bit the child's head off. A spray of blood showered Wolfgar, who was unable to draw breath, unable to comprehend that Ertu had found a way to get at him yet again, the worst way of all. Wolfgar half scrambled and half tumbled out of the tree, landing hard on his injured shoulder, reopening the wound. Ignoring the pain, he sprinted across the field and found Morik resting beside the wagon. Wolfgar went right to the crates and frantically tore one open. His children, the offspring of his stolen seed. The potent liquid burned all the way down, the heat of it spreading, spreading, dulling Wolfgar's senses, blurring the horrid images. Chapter 15 A Child No More.
"You must give love time to blossom, my lord," Temegast whispered to Lord Feringhal.
He ushered the young lord to the far side of the garden, away from Miralda, who was staring out over the seawall. The steward had discovered the amorous young man pressuring Miralda to marry him the very next 10 day. The flustered woman was making polite excuse after polite excuse, with stubborn Feringhal defeating each one.
"Time to blossom," Feringhal echoed incredulously. "I am going mad with desire. I can think of nothing but Miralda,"
he said the last loudly, and both men glanced to see a frowning Miralda looking back at them.
"As it should be," Steward Temegast whispered. "Let us discover if the feeling holds strong over the course of time. The duration of such feelings is the true meaning of love, my lord."
"You doubt me still?"
a horrified Lord Feringhal replied.
"No, my lord, not I," Temegast explained. "But the villagers must see your union to a woman of Miralda's station as true love and not infatuation. You must consider her reputation."
That last statement gave Lord Feringhal pause. He glanced back at the woman, then at Temegast, obviously confused.
"If she is married to me, then what harm could come to her reputation?"
"If the marriage is quickly brought, then the peasants will assume she used her womanly tricks to bewitch you," Temegast explained. "Better for her, by far, if you spend the 10 days showing your honest and respectful love for her. Many will resent her in any case, my lord, out of jealousy. Now you must protect her. And the best way to do that is to take your time with the engagement."
"How much time?"
the eager young lord asked.
"The spring equinox," Temegast offered, bringing another horrified look from Feringhal. "It is only proper."
"I shall die," wailed Feringhal.
Temegast frowned at the overwrought lord.
"We can arrange a meeting with another woman if your needs become too great."
Lord Feringhal shook his head vigorously.
"I cannot think of passion with another woman."
Smiling warmly, Temegast patted the young man on the shoulder.
"That is the correct answer for a man who is truly in love," he said. "Perhaps we can arrange the wedding for the turn of the year."
Lord Feringhal's face brightened. Then he frowned again.
5 months, he grumbled.
"But think of the pleasure when the time has passed."
"I think of nothing else,"
said a glum Feringhal.
"What were you speaking of?"
Miralda asked when Feringhal joined her by the wall after Temegast excused himself from the garden. "The wedding, of course," the lord replied. "Steward Temegast believes we must wait until the turn of the year. He believes love to be a growing, blossoming thing," said Feringhal, his voice tinged with doubt.
"And so it is,"
Miralda agreed with relief and gratitude to Temegast. Feringhal grabbed her suddenly and pulled her close.
"I cannot believe that my love for you could grow any stronger," he explained.
He kissed her, and Miralda returned it. And glad she was that he didn't try to take it any further than that, as had been his usual tactics. Instead, Lord Feringhal pushed her back to arm's length.
"Temegast has warned me to show my respect for you," he admitted, "to show the villagers that our love is a real and lasting thing. And so I shall by waiting. Besides, that will give Priscilla the time she needs to prepare the event. She has promised a wedding such as Orkney, as the whole of the North has never before seen."
Miralda's smile was genuine indeed. She was glad for the delay, glad for the time she needed to put her feelings for Lord Feringhal and Jacka in the proper order, to come to terms with her decision and her responsibility. Miralda was certain she could go through with this, and not as a suffering woman. She could marry Lord Feringhal and act as Lady of Orkney for the sake of her mother and her family, Perhaps it would not be such a terrible thing. The woman looked with a glimmer of affection at Feringel, who stood watching the dark waves. Impulsively, she put an arm around the man's waist and rested her head on his shoulder, and was rewarded with a chaste but grateful smile from her husband-to-be. He said nothing, didn't even try to take the touch further. Miralda had to admit it was pleasant.
"Oh, tell me everything,"
Tori whispered, scrambling to Miralda's bed when the older girl at last returned home that night.
"Did he touch you?"
"We talked and watched the waves,"
Miralda replied noncommittally.
"Do you love him yet?"
Miralda stared at her sister. Did she love Lord Feringel? No, she could say for certain she did not, at least not in the heated manner in which she longed for Jacka. But perhaps that was all right. Perhaps she would come to love the generous Lord of Orkney. Certainly Lord Feringel wasn't an ugly man, far from it. As their relationship grew, as they began to move beyond the tortured man's desperate groping, Miralda was starting to see his many good qualities, qualities she could indeed grow to love.
"Don't you still love Jacka?"
Tori asked. Miralda's contented smile dissipated at once with the painful reminder. She didn't answer, and for once Tori had the sense to let it drop as Miralda turned over, curled in upon herself, and tried hard not to cry. It was a night of torrid dreams that left her tangled in her blankets. Still, Miralda's mood was better that next morning, and it improved even more when she entered the common room to hear her mother talking with Ma'am Gardner, one of their nosier neighbors. The little gnome had a beak that could shame a vulture, happily telling the visitor about her stroll in the castle garden.
"Ma'am Gardner brought us some eggs,"
Beosta Ganderlay explained, pointing to a skillet of scrambled eggs.
"Help yourself, as I'm not wanting to get back up."
Miralda smiled at the generous gnome, then moved to the pan. Inexplicably, the young woman felt her stomach lurch at the sight and the smell and had to rush from the house to throw up beside the small bush outside the door. Ma'am Gardner was there beside her in an instant.
"Are you all right, girl?"
she asked. Miralda, more surprised than sick, stood back up.
"The rich food at the castle," she explained. "They're feeding me too good, I fear."
Ma'am Gardner howled with laughter.
"Oh, but you'll be getting used to that," she said. "All fat and plump you'll get, living easy and eating well."
Miralda returned her smile and went back into the house.
"You still got to eat,"
Ma'am Gardner said, guiding her toward the eggs. Even the thought of the eggs made Miralda's stomach turn again.
"I'm thinking that I need to go and lay down," she explained, pulling away to head back to her room.
She heard the older ladies discussing her plight, with Ma'am telling Beosta about the rich food. Beosta, no stranger to illness, hoped that to be all it was. Privately, Miralda wasn't so sure. Only then did she consider the timeline since her encounter with Jacka 2 10-days before. It was true she'd not had her monthly, but she hadn't thought much about it, for she'd never been regular in that manner anyway. The young woman clutched at her belly, both overwhelmed with joy and fear. She was sick again the next morning, and the next after that, but she was able to hide her condition by going nowhere near the smell or sight of eggs. She felt well after throwing up in the morning, and was not troubled with it after that. And so it became clear to her that she was indeed with child. In her fantasies, the thought of having Jacka Schooley's babe was not terrible. She could picture herself married to the young rogue, living in a castle, walking in the gardens beside him. But the reality of her situation was far more terrifying. She had betrayed the Lord of Orkney, and worse, she had betrayed her family. Stealing that one night for herself, she had likely condemned her mother to death and branded herself a whore in the eyes of all the village. Would it even get that far, she wondered. Perhaps when her father learned the truth, he would kill her. He'd beaten her for far less. Or perhaps Lord Feringal would have her paraded through the streets so that the villagers might taunt her and throw rotten fruit and spit upon her. Or perhaps in a fit of rage, Lord Feringal would cut the baby from her womb and send soldiers out to murder Jacka. What of the baby? What might the nobles of Orkney do to a child who was the result of the cuckolding of their lord? Meralda had heard stories of such instances in other kingdoms, tales of potential threats to the throne, tales of murdered infants. All the possibilities whirled in Meralda's mind one night as she lay in her bed, all the terrible possibilities, events too wicked for her to truly imagine, and too terrifying for her to honestly face. She rose and dressed quietly, then went in to see her mother, sleeping comfortably, curled up in her father's arms. Meralda silently mouthed a heart-sick apology to them both, then stole out of the house. It was a wet and windy night. To the woman's dismay, she didn't find Jacka in his usual spot in the fields above the houses, so she went to his house. Trying not to wake his kin, Meralda tossed pebbles against the curtain screening his glassless window. The curtain was abruptly yanked to the side, and Jacka's handsome face poked through the opening.
"It's me, Meralda,"
she whispered, and the young man's face brightened in surprise. He held his hand out to her, and when she clenched it, he pulled it close to his face through the opening, his smile wide enough to take in his ears.
"I must talk with you," Meralda explained. "Please come outside."
"It's warmer in here,"
Jacka replied in his usual sly, lewd tone. Knowing it unwise but shivering in the chill night air, Meralda motioned to the front door and scurried to it. Jacka was there in a moment, stripped bare to the waist and holding a single candle. He put his finger over his pursed lips and took Meralda by the arm, walking her quietly through the curtained doorway that led to his bedchamber. Before the young woman could begin to explain, Jacka was against her, kissing her, pulling her down beside him.
"Stop," she hissed, pulling away. "We must talk."
"Later,"
Jacka said, his hands roaming. Meralda rolled off the side of the bed and took a step away.
"Now," she said, "'tis important."
Jacka sat up on the edge of the bed, grinning still but making no move to pursue her.
"I'm running too late,"
Meralda explained bluntly. Jacka's face screwed up as though he didn't understand.
"I am with child,"
the woman blurted softly.
"Your child."
The effect of her words would have been no less dramatic if she had smashed Jacka across the face with a cudgel.
"How?"
he stammered after a long, trembling pause.
"It was only once." "I'm guessing that we did it right then,"
the woman returned dryly.
"But..."
Jacka started, shaking his head.
"Lord Feringal, what are we to do?"
He paused again, then turned a sharp eye upon Meralda.
"Have you and he..."
"Only yourself,"
Meralda firmly replied.
"Only that once in all my life."
"What are we to do?"
Jacka repeated, pacing nervously. Meralda had never seen him so agitated.
"I was thinking that I had to marry Lord Feringal,"
Meralda explained, moving over and taking hold of the man to steady him.
"For the sake of my family, if not my own. But now things are changed,"
she said, looking Jacka in the eyes.
"I cannot bring another man's child into Castle Auk after all."
"Then what?"
asked Jacka, still appearing on the very edge of desperation.
"You said you wanted me,"
Meralda said softly, hopefully.
"So, with what's in my belly, you've got me. And all my heart."
"Lord Feringal will kill me."
"We'll not stay then,"
Meralda replied.
"You said we'd travel the Sword Coast to Luskin and to Waterdeep, and so we shall, and so I must."
The thought didn't seem to sit very well with Jacka. He said,
"But,"
and shook his head repeatedly. Finally, Meralda gave him a shake to steady him and pushed herself up against him.
"Truly, this is for the better,"
she said.
You're my love as I'm your own, and now fate has intervened to put us together.
It's crazy, Jacka replied, pulling back from her.
We can't run away. We have no coin. We have nothing. We shall die on the road before we ever get near Luskin.
Nothing,
Meralda echoed incredulously, starting to realize that this was more than shock speaking.
We've each other. We've our love and our child coming.
You think that's enough?
Jacka asked in the same incredulous tone.
What life are we to find under such circumstances as this? Paupers forever? Eating mud and raising our child in mud?
What choice have we?
We?
Jacka bit back the word as soon as it left his mouth, realizing too late that it had not been wise to say aloud. Meralda fought back tears.
Are you saying that you lied to get me to lay down with you? Are you saying that you do not love me?
That's not what I'm saying,
Jacka reassured her, coming over to put a hand on her shoulder.
But what chance shall we have to survive? You don't really believe that love is enough, do you? We shall have no food, no coin, and three to feed. And how will it be when you get all fat and ugly, and we have not even our lovemaking to bring us joy?
The woman blanched and fell back from his reach. He came for her, but she slapped him away.
You said you loved me,
she said.
I did,
Jacka replied.
I do.
She shook her head slowly, eyes narrowing in a moment of clarity.
You lusted for me, but never loved me.
Her voice quivered, but the woman was determined to hold strong her course.
You fool. You're not even knowing the difference.
With that, she turned and ran out of the house. Jacka didn't make a move to go after her. Meralda cried all through the night on the rainy hillside and didn't return home until early in the morning. The truth was there before her now, whatever might happen next. What a fool she felt for giving herself to Jacka Schooley. For the rest of her life, when she would look back on the moment she became a woman, the moment she left her innocent life as a girl behind her, it would not be the night she lost her virginity. No, it would be this night, when she first realized she had given her most secret self to a selfish, uncaring, shallow man. No, not a man. A boy. What a fool she had been. Chapter 16 Home Sweet Home. They sat huddled under the wagon as the rain pelted down around them. Rivulets of water streamed in, and the ground became muddy even in their sheltered little place.
This is not the life I envisioned, a glum Morik remarked.
How the mighty have fallen. Wolfgar smirked at his friend and shook his head. He was not as concerned with physical comforts as Morik, for the rain hardly bothered him. He had grown up in Icewind Dale, after all, a climate more harsh by far than anything the foothills on this side of the spine of the world could offer.
Now I've ruined my best breeches, Morik grumbled, turning around and slapping the mud from his pants.
The farmers would have offered us shelter, Wolfgar reminded him.
Earlier that day, the pair had passed clusters of farmhouses, and Wolfgar had mentioned several times that the folk within would likely offer them food and a warm place to stay.
Then the farmers would know of us,
Morik said by way of explanation, the same answer he had given each time Wolfgar had brought up the possibility.
If or when we have someone looking for us, our trail will be easier to follow.
A bolt of lightning split a tree 100 yards away, bringing a startled cry from Morik.
You act as though you expect half the militias of the region to be chasing us before long, Wolfgar replied.
I have made many enemies, Morik admitted. As have you, my friend, including one of the leading magistrates of Luskin.
Wolfgar shrugged. He hardly cared.
We'll make more, I assure you,
Morek went on.
Because of the life you have chosen for us.
The rogue cocked an eyebrow.
Are we to live as farmers, tilling dirt?
Would that be so terrible?
Morek snorted, and Wulfgar only chuckled again helplessly.
We need a base,
Morek announced suddenly, as another rivulet found its way to his bottom.
A house. Or a cave.
There are many caves in the mountains, Wulfgar offered.
The look on Morek's face, both helpful and fearful, told him he needn't speak the thought. Mountain caves were almost always occupied. The sun was up the next morning, shining bright in a blue sky, but that did little to change Morek's complaining mood. He grumbled and slapped at the dirt, then stripped off his clothes and washed them when the pair came across a clear mountain stream. Wulfgar, too, washed his clothes and his dirty body. The icy water felt good against his injured shoulder. Lying on a sunny rock, waiting for their clothes to dry, Wulfgar spotted some smoke drifting lazily into the air.
More houses, the barbarian remarked. Friendly folk, to those who come as friends, no doubt.
You never stop,
Morek replied dryly, and he reached behind the rock and pulled out a bottle of wine he had cooling in the water. He took a drink and offered it to Wulfgar, who hesitated, then accepted. Soon after, their clothes still wet and both a bit lightheaded, the pair started off along the mountain trails. They couldn't take their wagon, so they stashed it under some brush and let the horses graze nearby, with Morek noting the irony of how easy it would be for someone to rob them.
Then we would just have to steal them back, Wulfgar replied.
And Morek started to laugh, missing the barbarian's sarcasm. He stopped abruptly, though, noting the suddenly serious expression on his large friend's face. Following Wolfgar's gaze to the trail ahead, Morek began to understand, for he spotted a broken sapling recently snapped just above the trunk. Wulfgar went to the spot and bent low, studying the ground around the sapling.
What do you think broke the tree?
Morek asked from behind him. Wulfgar motioned for the rogue to join him, then pointed out the heel print of a large, large boot.
Giants?
Morek asked, and Wulfgar looked at him curiously. Already, Wulfgar recognized the signs of Morek becoming unhinged, as the rogue had over the rat in the cage at Prisoner's Carnival.
You don't like giants either?
Wulfgar asked. Morek shrugged.
I have never seen one, he admitted. But who truly likes them?
Wulfgar stared at him incredulously. Morek was a seasoned veteran, skilled as a thief and warrior. A significant portion of Wolfgar's own training had come at the expense of giants. To think one as skilled as Morek had never even seen one surprised the barbarian.
I saw an ogre once, Morek said.
Of course our jailer friends had more than a bit of ogre blood in them.
Bigger, Wulfgar said bluntly. Giants are much bigger.
Morek blanched.
Let us return the way we came.
If there are giants about, they'll very likely have a lair, Wulfgar explained. Giants would not suffer rain and hot sun when there are comfortable caves in the region. Besides, they prefer their meals cooked, and they try not to advertise their presence with campfires under the open sky.
Their meals, Morek echoed. Are barbarians and thieves on their menu of cooked meals?
A delicacy,
Wulfgar said earnestly, nodding.
Let us go and speak with the farmers, said Morek, turning around.
Coward, Wulfgar remarked quietly.
The word had Morek spinning back to face him.
The trail is easy enough to follow, Wulfgar explained. We don't even know how many there are. Never would I have expected Morek the Rogue to run from a fight.
Morek the Rogue fights with this,
Morag countered, poking his finger against his temple.
A giant would eat that.
Then Morag the rogue runs with his feet, the thief said.
A giant would catch you, Wolfgar assured him. Or it would throw a rock at you and squash you from afar.
Pleasant choices, said Morag cynically.
Let us go and speak with the farmers.
Wolfgar settled back on his heels, studying his friend and making no move to follow. He couldn't help but contrast Morag to Drizzt at that moment. The rogue was turning to leave, while the drow would, and often had, eagerly rushed headlong into such adventure as a giant lair. Wolfgar recalled the time he and Drizzt had dispatched an entire lair of Verbeeg, a long and brutal fight, but one that Drizzt had entered laughing. Wolfgar thought of the last fight he had waged beside his ebon-skinned friend against another band of giants. That time they chased them into the mountains after learning that the brutes had set their eyes on the road to Ten Towns. It seemed to Wolfgar that Morag and Drizzt were similar in so many ways, but in the most important ways they were nothing alike. It was a contrast that continually nagged at Wolfgar, a reminder of the startling differences in his life now. The difference between that world north of the spine of the world and this world south of it.
There may only be a couple of giants, Wolfgar suggested. They rarely gather in large numbers.
Morag pulled out his slender sword and his dagger. 100 hits to fell one, he asked. 200? And all the time I spend sticking the behemoth 200 times, I'll be comforted by the thought that one strike from the giant will crush me flat. Wolfgar's grin widened.
That's the fun of it, he offered.
The barbarian hoisted the headman's axe over one shoulder and started after the giant, having little trouble in discerning the trail. Crouching on the backside of a wide boulder by mid-afternoon, Wolfgar and Morag had the giants and their lair in sight. Even Morag had to admit that the location was perfect, an out-of-the-way cave nestled among rocky crests. Yet less than half a day's march to one of two primary mountain passes, the easternmost of the pair, separating Icewind Dale from the Southlands. They watched for a long while and noted only a pair of giants. Then a third appeared. Even so, Wolfgar was not impressed.
Hill giants, he remarked disparagingly, and only a trio. I have battled a single mountain giant who could fell all three.
Well, let us see if we can find that mountain giant and prompt him to come and evict this group, said Morag.
That mountain giant is dead, Wolfgar replied, as these three shall soon be.
He took up the huge axe in hand and glanced around, finally deciding on a roundabout trail that would bring him to the lair.
I have no idea how to fight them, Morag whispered.
Watch and learn,
Wolfgar replied, and off he went. Morag didn't know whether he should follow or not, so he stayed put on the rock, noting his friend's progress, watching the trio of giants disappear into the cave. Wolfgar crept up to that dark entrance soon after, slipping to the edge and peering in. Glancing back Morag's way, he went spinning into the gloom.
You don't even know if there are others inside,
Morag muttered to himself, shaking his head. He wondered if coming out here with Wolfgar had been a wise idea after all. The rogue could get back into Luskan easily, he knew, with a new identity as far as the authorities were concerned, but with the same old position of respect on the streets. Of course there remained the not-so-little matter of the dark elves who had come calling. Still, given the size of those giants, Morag was thinking that he might just have to return to Luskan alone. The initial passageway inside the cave was not very high or open, at least for giants. Wolfgar took comfort in the knowledge that his adversaries would have to stoop very low, perhaps even crawl to get under one overhanging boulder. Pursuit would not be swift if Wolfgar were forced to retreat. The tunnel widened and heightened considerably beyond that curving walk of about 50 feet. After that it opened into a wide, high chamber, where a tremendous bonfire reflected enough orange light down the tunnel so that Wulfgar was not walking in darkness. He noticed that the walls were broken and uneven, a place of shadows. There was one particularly promising perch about 10 feet off the ground. Wulfgar crept along a bit farther, hoping to catch a glimpse of the entire giant clan within. He wanted to make sure that there were only three, and that they didn't have any of the dangerous pets giants often harbored, like cave bears or huge wolves. The barbarian had to backtrack, though, before he even got near the chamber entrance, for he heard one of the giants approaching, belching with every booming step. Wulfgar went up the wall to the perch and melted back into the shadows to watch. Out came the giant, rubbing its belly and belching yet again. It stooped and bent in preparation for the tight stretch of corridor ahead. Caution dictated that Wulfgar hold his attack, that he scout further and discern the exact strength of his enemy. But Wulfgar wasn't feeling cautious. Down he came with a great roar and a tremendous overhead chop of the headsman's axe, his pure strength adding to the momentum of the drop. The startled giant managed a slight dodge, enough so that the axe didn't shear through its neck. Despite its great size, Wulfgar's power would have decapitated the behemoth. Still, the axe drove through the giant's shoulder blade, tearing skin and muscle and crushing bone, knocking the giant into a howling, agonized stagger that left it crouched on one knee. But in the process, Wulfgar's weapon snapped at mid-shaft. Ever one to improvise, the barbarian hit the ground in a roll, came right back to his feet, and rushed in on the wounded kneeling giant, stabbing it hard in the throat with the pointed, broken end of the shaft. As the gurgling behemoth reached for him with huge, trembling hands, Wulfgar tore the shaft free, tightened his grip on the end, and smashed the giant across the face. He left the giant there on one knee, knowing that its friends would soon come out. Looking for a defensible position, he noticed then that the action of his attack, or perhaps the landing on the floor, had reopened his shoulder wound, his tunic already growing wet with fresh blood. Wulfgar didn't have time to think about it. He made it back to his high perch as the other two entered the area below him. He found his next weapon in the form of a huge rock. With a stifled grunt, Wulfgar brought it up overhead and waited. The last giant in line, the smallest of the three, heard that grunt and looked up just as Wulfgar brought the rock smashing down, and how that giant howled. Wulfgar scooped his club and leaped down, once again using his momentum to heighten the strike as he smashed this one across the face. The barbarian hit the floor and pivoted back at the behemoth, rushing past its legs to smash at its kneecaps. Altering his grip, he stabbed hard at the tender hamstrings on the back of the giant's legs, just as Brunner had taught him. Still holding its smashed face and howling in pain, the giant tumbled to the ground behind Wulfgar, where it fell in the way of the last of the group, the only one who had not yet felt the sting of Wolfgar's weapons. Outside the cave, Morik winced as he heard the cries, groans, and howls, and the unmistakable sound of boulder against bone. Curious despite himself, the rogue moved up closer to the entrance, trying to get a look inside, though he feared and honestly believed that his friend was already dead. "You should be well on your way to Luskin," Morik scolded himself under his breath. "A warm bed for Morik tonight." He'd hit them as hard as he could both times, yet he hadn't killed a single one of the trio, probably hadn't even knocked one of them out of the fight for long. Here he was, exposed and running into the main chamber without even knowing if the place had another exit. But memories of Ertu weren't with the barbarian now. He was temporarily free of that emotional bondage, on the very edge of present desperation, and he loved it. For once luck was with him. Inside the lair proper, Wulfgar found the spoils of the giant's last raid, including the remains of a trio of dwarves, one of whom had carried a small though solid hammer, and another with several hand axes set along a bandolier. Roaring, the giant rushed in, and Wulfgar let fly 1, 2, 3 with the hand axes, scoring 2 gouging hits. Still the brute came on, and it was only a single running stride away when a desperate Wolfgar, thinking he was about to get squished into the wall, spun the hammer right into its thigh. Wolfgar dived desperately, for the staggering giant couldn't begin to halt its momentum. It slammed headlong into the stone wall, dropping more than a bit of dust and pebbles from the cave ceiling. Somehow, Wolfgar managed to avoid the crunch, but he had left his new weapons behind and couldn't possibly get to them in time as the giant Wolfgar had smashed with the rock came limping into the chamber. Wolfgar went for the snapped axe shaft instead. Scooping it up, he dived aside in another roll as the behemoth stomped down with a heavy boot. Wolfgar was already in motion, charging for those vulnerable knees, smashing one repeatedly, then spinning around the trunk-like leg out of the giant's grasp. Turning his weapon point out as he pivoted, he stabbed again at the back of the bloodied leg. The giant, lying across the wall, kicked out, clipping Wolfgar's wounded shoulder and launching the man away to slam hard against the far wall. Wolfgar was in his warrior rage now. He came out of the slam with a bellow, charging right back at the limping behemoth too fast for it to recognize the movement. His relentless club went at the knees again, and though the giant slapped at him, Wolfgar took hope in finally hearing the bone crunch apart. Down went the behemoth, clutching its broken knee, the sheer volume of its cries shaking the entire cave. Shaking off the dull ache of that slap, Wolfgar taunted it with laughter. The one against the wall tried to rise, but Wolfgar was there in an instant, standing on its back, his club battering it about the back of the head. He scored several thunderous hits and had the behemoth flat down and trying to cover. Wolfgar dared hope he might finally finish one off. Then the huge hand of the other giant tightened around his leg.
Morik could hardly believe his movements, felt as if his own feet were betraying him as he crept right up to the cave entrance and peered inside. He saw the first of the giant group standing bent over at the waist under the overhanging rock, one arm extended against the wall to lend support as it coughed up the last remnants of blood from its mouth. Before his own good sense could overrule him, Morik was on the move, silently creeping into the gloom of the cave along the wall. He got by the giant with hardly a whisper of sound, his small noises easily covered by the giant's hacking and wheezing, then climbed to a ledge several feet from the ground. The sounds of battle rang out from the inner chamber, and he could only hope that Wolfgar was doing well, both for his friend's sake and because he realized that if the other giants came out now, he would be in a difficult position indeed. The rogue held his nerve and waited, poised, dagger in hand, lining up his strike. He considered the attack from the perspective of those backstabs he knew from his experiences fighting men, but he looked at his puny dagger doubtfully. The giant began to turn around. Morik was out of time. Knowing he had to be perfect, figuring that this was going to hurt more than a little, and wondering why in the nine hells he had come in here after foolish Wolfgar, Morik went with his instinct and leaped for the giant's torn throat. His dagger flashed. The giant howled and leaped up, slammed its head on the overhanging boulder. Groaning, it tried to straighten, flailing its arms, and Morik flew aside, his breath blasted away. Half tumbling, half running, and surely screaming, Morik exited the cave with a gasping, grasping giant right behind. He felt the giant closing, step by step. At the last instant, Morik dived aside, and the behemoth stumbled past, one hand clutching its throat, wheezing horribly, its face blue, eyes bulging. Morik sprinted back the other way, but the giant didn't pursue. The huge creature was down on its knees now, gasping for air. "Going home to Luskin," Morik mumbled over and over, but he kept moving for the cave entrance as he spoke. Wolfgar spun and stabbed with all his strength, then drove ahead ferociously, twisting and pulling at the giant's leg. The giant was on one knee, its broken leg held straight out as it struggled to maintain some balance. The other meaty hand came at Wolfgar, but he slipped under it and pulled on furiously, breaking free and leaping to the giant's shoulder.
He scrambled behind the behemoth's head and wrapped his hands back around, lining up the point of his axe shaft with the creature's eye. Wolfgar locked his hands around that splintered pole and pushed hard. The giant's hands grabbed at him to stop his progress, but he growled and pulled on. The terrified giant tried to wriggle away, pulled with its huge hands with all its strength, bunched muscle that would stop nearly any human cold. But Wolfgar had the angle and was possessed of a strength beyond that of nearly any human. He saw the other giant climbing back to its feet, but reminded himself to take the fight one at a time. Wolfgar felt the tip of his axe shaft sink into the giant's eye. It went into a frenzy, even climbing back to its feet, but Wolfgar held on, driving, driving. The giant ran blindly for the wall and turned around, going in hard, trying to crush the man. Wolfgar growled away the pain and pressed on with all his strength until the spear slipped in deeper to the behemoth's brain. The other giant came in then. Wolfgar fell away, scrambling across the chamber, using the spasms of the dying giant to cover his retreat. The butt end of Wolfgar's impromptu spear remained visible within the folds of the dying brute's closed eyelid. Wolfgar scarcely had time to notice as he dived headlong across the way to retrieve the hammer and one of the bloody hand axes. The giant threw its dead companion aside and strode forward, then staggered back with a hand axe embedded deep into its forehead. Wolfgar continued to press in with a mighty overhead chop that slammed the hammer hard into the behemoth's chest. He hit it again and a third time, then went down under the flailing fists and struck a brutal blow against the giant's knee. Wolfgar skittered past and ran behind the brute to the wall, leaping upward two full strides, then springing off with yet another wicked downward smash as the turning giant came around. The hammer's head cracked through the giant's skull. The behemoth dropped straight down and lay very still on the floor. Morik entered the chamber at that moment and gaped at the battered Wolfgar. The barbarian's shoulder was soaked with blood, his leg bruised from ankle to thigh, and his knees and hands were skinned raw.
"You see," Wolfgar said with a triumphant grin, "no trouble at all. Now we have a home."
Morik looked past his friend to the gruesome remains of the half-eaten dwarves, and the two giants oozing blood throughout the chamber. "Such as it is," he answered dryly. They spent the better part of the next 3 days cleaning out their cave, burying the dwarves, chopping up and disposing of the giants, and retrieving their supplies. They even managed to get the horses and the wagon up to the place along a roundabout route, though they simply let the horses run free after the great effort, figuring that they would never be very useful as a pulling team. A full pack on his back, Morik took Wolfgar out along the trails. The pair finally came to a spot overlooking a wide pass, the one true trail through this region of the spine of the world. It was the same trail that Wolfgar and his former friends had used whenever they'd ventured out of Icewind Dale. There was another pass to the west that ran through Hundlestone, but this was the most direct route, though more dangerous by far. "Many caravans will roll through this place before winter," Morik explained. "They'll be heading north with varied goods and south with scrimshaw knucklehead carvings." More familiar with the routine than Morik would ever understand, Wolfgar merely nodded. "We should hit them both ways," the rogue suggested. "Secure our provisions from those coming from the south, and our future monies from those coming from the north." Wolfgar sat down on a slab and stared north along the pass, beyond it to Icewind Dale. He was reminded again of the sharp contrast between his past and his present. How ironic it would be if his former friends were the ones to track down the highwayman. He pictured Brunner, roaring as he charged up the rocky slope, agile Drizzt skipping past him, scimitars in hand. Guinevar would already be above them, Wolfgar knew, cutting off any retreat. Morik would likely flee, and Catti Bree would cut him down with a single blazing arrow. "You look 1,000 miles away. What's on your mind?" Morik inquired.
As usual, he was holding an open bottle he'd already begun sampling.
"I'm thinking I need a drink,"
Wulfgar replied, taking the bottle and lifting it to his lips. Burning all the way down, the huge swallow helped calm him somewhat, but he still couldn't reconcile himself to his present position. Perhaps his friends would come after him. As he, Drizzt, and Guinevere, and the others following, had gone after the giant band they suspected to be highwaymen in Icewind Dale. Wulfgar took another long drink. He didn't like the prospect if they came after him. Chapter 17 Coercion.
"I cannot wait until the spring, I fear,"
Miralda said coyly to Feringel after dinner one night at Orkney Castle. At Miralda's request, the pair was walking the seashore this evening, instead of their customary stroll in the garden. The young lord stopped in his tracks, eyes wider than Miralda had ever seen them. "The waves," he said, drawing closer to Miralda.
"I fear I did not hear you correctly."
"I said that I cannot wait for the spring," Miralda repeated. "For the wedding, I mean."
A grin spread from ear to ear across Feringel's face, and he seemed as if he were about to dance a jig. He took her hand gently, brought it up to his lips, and kissed it.
"I would wait until the end of time if you so commanded," he said solemnly.
To her great surprise, and wasn't this man always full of surprises, Miralda found that she believed him. He had never betrayed her. As thrilled as Miralda was, however, she had pressing problems.
"No, my lord, you'll not be waiting long,"
she replied, pulling her hand from his and stroking his cheek.
"Sure, and I'm glad that you'd wait for me, but I can no longer wait for the spring for my own desires."
She moved in close and kissed him, and felt him melting against her. Feringel pulled away from her for the first time.
"You know we cannot," he said, though it obviously pained him. "I have given my word to Temegast. Propriety, my love, propriety."
"Then make it proper, and soon,"
Miralda replied, stroking the man's cheek gently. She thought that Feringel might collapse under her tender touch, so she moved in close again and added breathlessly,
"I simply can't wait."
Feringel lost his thin resolve and wrapped her in his arms, burying her in a kiss. Miralda didn't want this, but she knew what she had to do. She feared too much time had passed already. The young woman started to pull the man down to the sand with her, setting her mind firmly that she would seduce him and be done with it. But there came a call from the castle wall, Priscilla's shrill voice, "Fairy?"
"I detest it when she calls me that."
With great effort, the young lord jumped back from Miralda and cursed his sister under his breath.
"Can I never escape her?"
"Fairy, is that you?"
Priscilla called again.
"Yes, Priscilla,"
the man replied with barely concealed irritation.
"Do come back to the castle,"
the woman beckoned.
"It grows dark, and Temegast says there are reports of thieves about. He wants you within the walls."
Broken-hearted Feringel looked to Miralda and shook his head.
"We must go," he said.
"I can't wait for spring,"
the woman said determinedly.
"And you shan't,"
Lord Feringel replied.
"But we shall do it properly, in accordance with etiquette. I will move the wedding day forward to the winter solstice."
"Too long,"
Miralda replied.
"The autumn equinox, then."
Miralda considered the timeline. The autumn equinox was 4 10 days away, and she was already more than a month pregnant. Her expression revealed her dismay.
"I cannot possibly move it up more than that," Lord Feringel explained. "As you know, Priscilla is doing the planning, and she will already howl with anger when she hears that I wish to move it up at all. Temegast desires that we wait until the turn of the year at least, but I will convince him otherwise."
He was talking more to himself than to Miralda, and so she let him ramble, falling within her own thoughts as the pair made their way back to the castle. She knew that the man's fears of his sister's rage were, if anything, an underestimation. Priscilla would fight their plans for a change of date. Meralda was certain the woman was hoping the whole thing would fall apart. It would fall apart before the wedding if anyone suspected she was carrying another man's child.
"You should know better than to go out without guards in the night," Priscilla scolded as soon as the pair entered the foyer. "There are thieves about."
She glared at Meralda, and the woman knew the truth of Priscilla's ire. Feringel's sister didn't fear thieves on her brother's account. Rather, she was afraid of what might happen between Feringel and Miranda, of what had nearly happened between them on the beach.
"Thieves?" Feringel replied with a chuckle. "There are no thieves in Orkney. We have had no trouble here in many years, not since before I became lord."
"Then we are overdue," Priscilla replied dryly. "Would you have it that the first attack in Orkney in years happen upon the lord and his future wife? Have you no sense of responsibility toward the woman you say you love?"
That set Feringel back on his heels. Priscilla always seemed able to do that with just a few words. She made a mental note to remedy that situation as soon as she had a bit of power behind her.
"'Twas my own fault," Meralda interrupted, moving between the siblings. "I'm often walking the night, my favorite time."
"You are no longer a common peasant," Priscilla scolded bluntly. "You must understand the responsibility that will accompany your ascent into the family."
"Yes, Lady Priscilla," Meralda replied, dipping a polite curtsy, head bowed.
"If you wish to walk at night, do so in the garden," Priscilla added, her tone a bit less harsh.
Meralda, head still bowed so that Priscilla could not see her face, smiled knowingly. She was beginning to figure out how to get to the woman. Priscilla liked a feisty target, not an agreeable, humble one. Priscilla turned to leave with a frustrated huff.
"We have news," Lord Feringel said suddenly, stopping the woman short.
Meralda's head shot up, her face flushed with surprise and more than a little anger. She wanted to choke her intended's words back at that moment. The time for the announcement had not yet come.
"We have decided that we cannot wait until the spring to marry," the oblivious Feringel went on. "The wedding shall be on the day of the autumn equinox."
As expected, Priscilla's face turned bright red. It was obviously taking all of the woman's willpower to keep her from shaking.
"Indeed," she said through clenched teeth. "And have you shared your news with Steward Temegast?"
"You're the first," Lord Feringel replied, "out of courtesy, and since you are the one making the wedding preparations."
"Indeed,"
Priscilla said again with ice in her voice.
"Do go tell him, Ferry," she bade. "He is in the library. I will see that Meralda is escorted home."
That brought Lord Feringel rushing back to Meralda.
"Not so long now, my love," he said. Gently kissing her knuckles, he strode away eagerly to find the steward.
"What did you do to him out there?"
Priscilla snapped at Meralda as soon as her brother was gone. Meralda pursed her lips.
"Do? You, worked your charms upon him, didn't you?"
Meralda laughed out loud at Priscilla's efforts to avoid coarse language, a response the imposing Priscilla certainly did not expect.
"Perhaps I should have," she replied. "Put a calming on the beast, we call it. But no, I didn't. I love him, you know, but my ma didn't raise a slut. Your brother's to marry me, and so we'll wait until the autumn equinox, by his own words."
Priscilla narrowed her eyes threateningly.
"You hate me for it,"
Meralda accused her bluntly. Priscilla was not prepared for that. Her eyes widened, and she fell back a step.
"You hate me for taking your brother and disrupting the life you had set out for yourself. But I'm finding that to be a bit selfish, if I might be saying so. Your brother loves me, and I him, and so we're to marry, with or without your blessings."
"How dare you! I dare tell the truth,"
cut in Meralda, surprised at her own forwardness, but knowing she could not back down.
My ma won't live the winter in our freezing house, and I'll not let her die. Not for the sake of what's proper, and not for your own troubles. I know you're doing the planning, and so I'm grateful to you, but do it faster.
That is what this is all about, then?
Priscilla asked, thinking she had found a weakness here.
Your mother?
'Tis about your brother,
Miralda replied, standing straight, shoulders squared.
About Feringal, and not about Priscilla, and that's what's got you so bound up.
Priscilla was so overwrought and surprised that she couldn't even force an argument out of her mouth. Flustered, she turned and fled, leaving Miralda alone in the foyer. The young woman spent a long moment considering her own words, hardly able to believe that she had stood her ground with Priscilla. She considered her next move and thought it prudent to be leaving. She'd spotted Liam with the coach out front when she and Feringal had returned. So she went to him and bade him to take her home. He watched the coach travel down the road from the castle, as he did every time Miralda returned from another of her meetings with the Lord of Orkney. Jack Ascoli didn't know what to make of his own feelings. He kept thinking back to the moment when Miralda had told him about the child, about his child. He had rebuffed her, allowing his guard to slip so that his honest feelings showed clearly on his face. Now this was his punishment, watching her come back down the road from Castle Auk, from him. What might Jacka have done differently? He surely didn't want the life Miralda had offered, never that. The thought of marrying the woman, of her growing fat and ugly with a crying baby about, horrified him, but perhaps not as much as the thought of Lord Feringal having her. That was it, Jacka understood now, though the rationalization did little to change what he felt in his heart. He couldn't bear the notion of Miralda lying down for the man, of Lord Feringal raising Jacka's child as if it were his own. It felt as if the man were stealing from him outright, as every lord in every town did to the peasants in more subtle ways. Yes, they always took from the peasants, from honest folk like Jacka. They lived in comfort, surrounded by luxury, while honest folk like Jacka broke their fingernails in the dirt and ate rotten food. They took the women of their choice, offering nothing of character, only wealth, against which peasants like Jacka could not compete. Feringal took his woman, and now he would take Jacka's child. Trembling with rage, Jacka impulsively ran down to the road, waving his arms, bidding the coach to stop.
"Begone!"
Liam Woodgate called down from above, not slowing one bit.
"I must speak with Miralda," Jacka cried. "It is about her ma."
That made Liam slow the coach enough so that he could glance down and get Miralda's thoughts. The young woman poked her head out the coach window to learn the source of the commotion. Spotting an obviously agitated Jacka, she blanched but did not retreat.
"He wants me to stop so he can speak with you. Something about your ma," the coachman explained.
Miralda eyed Jacka warily.
"I'll speak with him," she agreed. "You can stop and let me out here, Liam."
"Still a mile to your home,"
the gnome driver observed, none too happy about the disturbance.
"I could be taking you both there," he offered.
Miralda thanked him and waved him away.
"A mile I'll walk easy," she answered,
and was out the door before the coach had even stopped rolling, leaving her alone on the dark road with Jacka.
"You're a fool to be out here,"
Miralda scolded as soon as Liam had turned the coach around and rambled off.
"What are you about?"
"I had no choice,"
Jacka replied, moving to hug her. She pushed him away.
"You know what I'm carrying," the woman went on. "And so will Lord Feringal soon enough. If he puts you together with my child, he'll kill us both."
"I'm not afraid of him," Jacka said, pressing toward her. "I know only how I feel, Miralda. I had no choice but to come to you tonight."
"You've made your feelings clear enough," the woman replied coldly.
"What a fool I was,"
Jacka protested.
"You must understand what a shock the news was, but I'm over that. Forgive me, Miralda. I cannot live without your charity."
Miralda closed her eyes.
her body swaying as she tried to digest it all.
"What are you about, Jack Askuli?"
she asked again quietly.
"Where's your heart?" "With you,"
he answered softly, coming closer.
"And?"
she prompted, opening her eyes to stare hard at him. He didn't seem to understand.
"Have you forgotten the little one already, then?"
she asked.
"No," he blurted, catching on. "I love the child, too, of course."
Miralda found that she did not believe him, and her expression told him so.
"Miralda," he said, taking her hands and shaking his head, "I can't bear the thought of Lord Feringal raising my..."